Summer. Most of the summer I spent in a stupor, sitting either in my office or in new restaurants, in my apartment watching videotapes, or in the backs of cabs, in nightclubs that just opened, or in movie theaters, at the building in Hell's Kitchen, or in new restaurants. There were 4 major air disasters this summer, the majority of them captured on videotape, almost as if these events had been planned and repeated on television endlessly. The planes kept crashing in slow motion, followed by countless roaming shots of the wreckage and the same random views of the burned, bloody carnage, weeping rescue workers retrieving body parts. I started using Oscar de la Renta men's deodorant, which gave me a slight rash. A movie about a small talking bug was released to great fanfare and grossed over $200 million. The Mets were doing badly. Beggars and homeless seemed to have multiplied in August, and the ranks of the unfortunate, weak, and aged lined the streets everywhere. I found myself asking too many summer associates at too many flashy dinners and new restaurants before taking them to Les Miserables if anyone had seen The Toolbox Murders on HBO, and silent tables would stare back at me before I would cough politely and summon the waiter over for the check, or I'd ask for sorbet, or, if this was earlier in the evening, for another bottle of San Pellegrino, and then I'd ask the summer associates, no, and assure them it was quite good. My platinum American Express card had gone through so much use that it snapped in half, self-destructed, at one of those dinners. When I took 2 summer associates to Restless and Young, the new Pablo Lester restaurant in Midtown, but I had enough cash in my gazelle skin wallet to pay for the meal. Patty Winter's shows were all repeats. Life remained a blank canvas, a cliché, a soap opera. I felt lethal, on the verge of frenzy. My nightly bloodlust overflowed into my days, and I had to leave the city. My mask of sanity was a victim of impending slippage. This was the bone season for me, and I needed a vacation. I needed to go to the Hamptons. I suggested this to Evelyn, and like a spider, she accepted. The house we stayed at was actually Tim Price's, which Evelyn had the keys to for some reason, but in my stupefied state I refused to ask for specifics. Tim's house was on the water in East Hampton, and was adorned with many gable roofs, and was 4 stories high, all connected by a galvanized steel staircase, and had what at first I thought was a southwestern motif, but wasn't. The kitchen was 1,000 square feet of pure minimalist design. One wall held everything. 2 huge ovens, massive cupboards, a walk-in freezer, a 3-door refrigerator. An island of custom-crafted stainless steel divided the kitchen into 3 separate spaces. 4 of the 9 bathrooms contained trompe-l'oeil paintings, and 5 of them had antique lead ram's heads that hung over the sink, water spouting from their mouths. All the sinks and bathtubs and showers were antique marble, and the floors were composed of tiny marble mosaics. A television was built into a wall alcove above the master bathtub. Every room had a stereo. The house also contained 12 Frank Lloyd Wright standing lamps, 14 Josef Heffermann club chairs, 2 walls of floor-to-ceiling video cassette cases, and another wall stacked solely with thousands of compact discs encased in glass cabinets. A chandelier by Eric Schmidt hung in the front entranceway. Below it stood an atomic ironwork steel moose hat rack by a young sculptor I've never heard of. A round 19th-century Russian dining table sat in a room adjacent to the kitchen, but had no chairs. Spooky photographs by Cindy Sherman lined the walls everywhere. There was an exercise room. There were 8 walk-in closets, 5 VCRs, a Noguchi glass and walnut dining table, a hall table by Mark Schaffer, and a fax machine. There was a topiary tree in the master bedroom next to a Louis XVI window bench. An Eric Fischel painting hung over one of the marble fireplaces. There was a tennis court. There were 2 saunas and an indoor jacuzzi in a small guest house that sat by the pool, which was black-bottomed. There were stone columns in odd places. I really tried to make things work the weeks we were out there. Evelyn and I rode bicycles and jogged and played tennis. We talked about going to the south of France or to Scotland. We talked about driving through Germany and visiting unspoiled opera houses. We went windsurfing. We talked about only romantic things, the light on eastern Long Island, the moonrise in October over the hills of the Virginia Hunt Country. We took baths together in the big marble tubs. We had breakfast in bed, snuggling beneath cashmere blankets after I'd poured imported coffee from a Melior pot into Hermes cups. I woke her up with fresh flowers. I put notes in her Louis Vuitton carry bag before she left for her weekly facials in Manhattan. I bought her a puppy, a small black chow, which she named NutraSweet and fed dietetic chocolate truffles to. I read long passages aloud from Dr. Zhivago and A Farewell to Arms, my favorite Hemingway. I rented movies in town that Price didn't own, mostly comedies from the 1930s, and played them on one of the many VCRs, our favorite being Roman Holiday, which we watched twice. We listened to Frank Sinatra, only his 1950s period, and Nat King Cole's After Midnight, which Tim had on CD. I bought her expensive lingerie, which sometimes she wore. After skinny dipping in the ocean late at night, we would come into the house, shivering, draped in huge Ralph Lauren towels. We'd make omelets and noodles, tossed with olive oil and truffles and porcini mushrooms. We'd make soufflés with peppered salmon, apple and berry sorbet, mascarpone, red beans with orzo wrapped in romaine lettuce, bowls of salsa and skate poached in balsamic vinegar, chilled tomato soup and risottos flavored with beets and lime and asparagus and mint. And we drank lemonade or champagne or well-aged bottles of Chateau Margaux. But soon we stopped lifting weights together and swimming laps, and Evelyn would eat only the dietetic chocolate truffles that NutraSweet hadn't eaten, complaining about the weight she hadn't gained. Some nights I would find myself roaming the beaches, digging up baby crabs and eating handfuls of sand. This was in the middle of the night when the sky was so clear I could see the entire solar system, and the sand lit by it seemed almost lunar in scale. I even dragged a beach jellyfish back to the house and microwaved it early one morning, pre-dawn, while Evelyn slept, and when I didn't eat of it, I fed to the chow. Sipping bourbon, then champagne, from cactus-etched highball glasses, which Evelyn would set on adobe coasters, and into which she would stir raspberry cassis with papier-mâché jalapeno-shaped stirrers, I would lie around, fantasizing about killing someone with an all-sop racer ski pole, or I would stare at the antique weather vane that hung above one of the fireplaces, wondering wild-eyed if I could stab anyone with it. Then I'd complain aloud, whether Evelyn was in the room or not, that we should have made reservations at Dick Loudon's Stratford Inn instead. Evelyn soon started talking only about spas and cosmetic surgery, and then she hired a masseur, some scary faggot who lived down the road with a famous book publisher and who flirted openly with me. Evelyn went back to the city 3 times that last week we were in the Hamptons, once for a manicure and a pedicure and a facial, the second time for a one-on-one training session at Stephanie Herman, and finally to meet with her astrologer. "Why helicopter in?" I asked in a whisper. "What do you want me to do?" she shrieked, popping another dietetic truffle into her mouth. "Rent a Volvo?" While she was gone, I would vomit, just to do it, into the rustic terracotta jars that lined the patio in front, or I would drive into town with the scary masseur and collect razor blades. At night, I'd place a faux concrete and aluminum wire sconce by Jerry Cott over Evelyn's head, and since she'd be so knocked out on Halcyon, she wouldn't brush it off. And though I laughed at this, while the sconce rose evenly with her deep breathing, soon it made me sad, and I stopped placing the sconce over Evelyn's head. Everything failed to subdue me. Soon everything seemed dull. Another sunrise, the lives of heroes, falling in love, war, the discoveries people made about each other. The only thing that didn't bore me, obviously enough, was how much money Tim Price made, and yet, in its obviousness, it did. There wasn't a clear, identifiable emotion within me, except for greed and possibly total disgust. I had all the characteristics of a human being: flesh, blood, skin, hair. But my depersonalization was so intense, had gone so deep, that the normal ability to feel compassion had been eradicated, the victim of a slow, purposeful erasure. I was simply imitating reality, a rough resemblance of a human being, with only a dim corner of my mind functioning. Something horrible was happening, and yet I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't put my finger on it. The only thing that calmed me was the satisfying sound of ice being dropped into a glass of J&B. Eventually, I drowned the chow, which Evelyn didn't miss. She didn't even notice its absence, not even when I threw it in the walk-in freezer, wrapped in one of her sweaters from Bergdorf Goodman. We had to leave the Hamptons because I would find myself standing over our bed in the hours before dawn, with an ice pick gripped in my fist, waiting for Evelyn to open her eyes. At my suggestion, one morning over breakfast, she agreed, and on the last Sunday before Labor Day, we returned to Manhattan by helicopter.